nodded, rolling a dislocated shoulder back into place with a grunt and staggering back toward my opponent. Behind me, Zeb yelled, "She tried to hurt Fitz!" He turned to Gabriel and Dick.
"That'll get her mad."
Gabriel rolled his eyes. "She's been framed for murder twice over, shot in the back, her arms were set on fire, and her parents are being held hostage. You think tampered dog water is what's going to make her angry?" "You tried to hurt my dog!" I wheezed as I lurched toward a grinning Missy.
"Oh, big deal," Missy huffed. "It's the ugliest dog I've ever seen."
"You tried to hurt my dog," I said again.
"I would have been doing you a favor," Missy sneered.
"Nobody screws with my dog," I growled, punctuating each word with a punch to Missy's face. I gave an uppercut to the chin that sent her flying back into a pile on the ground. Zeb grinned at Dick and Gabriel.
"Told you."
I took a running start at Missy, hoping to drive my elbow into her chest, but she rolled out of the way, kicking me in the back of the head when I face-planted into the dirt. Ow. I pushed up to my knees, but Missy tackled me, throwing me to the ground, cursing and pulling my hair. I tried every move I'd ever seen on the rare evening Zeb got me to watch wrestling, headbutting, eye-gouging, ear-pulling, but nothing would get Missy off me. Still rolling in our cartoon fight ball of flying fists and cat yowls, we knocked into the storage shed, popping the door open. A slew of Missy's old realtor signs spilled out, their pointy wooden stakes glinting like a dozen golden opportunities. We glanced at the stakes, looked at each other, and dove. I landed first, with Missy grabbing my ankles to pull me away. I managed to snag one as she dragged me face down over the grass. Spitting dirt and grass and a couple of foul words, I sprang to my feet. Missy was still on her back, hate and surprise radiating from her eyes as I lunged and drove the sign through her chest. Missy howled, wriggling to free herself from the spike pinning her to the ground.
"The heart, you moron," she screeched, clutching at the stake. "It has to be the heart."
"Oh, right, thanks," I said, grabbing another sign. I screamed as I drove it home, aiming more carefully this time. She looked down at the wood pinning her heart, disbelief flickering over her features before they crumbled away to dust. It happened in a wave, first the skin, then the musculature, then a bare skeleton that exploded in a cloud of particles. The sign swayed once, twice, then fell flat, pushing Missy's smiling photo into the mound of her dust.
"Get the point?"
I asked, offering the boys a triumphant smile. Gabriel, Zeb, and Dick stared at me, aghast.
"What? Sarcastic post-kill comeback? Isn't that what you're supposed to do in situations like this? Too harsh?"
Chapter 21. You cannot control your family's reaction to your new lifestyle. You can only control your reaction to your family. It's best if that reaction does not include eating your family. From the Guide for the Newly Undead. Gabriel offered to wipe my family's memories. It was so tempting to hide for a little bit longer, to let one area of my life stay the same for just a little while. But I'd had enough. The lies took too much energy, and frankly, I was having a hard time keeping track of to whom I'd told what. Gabriel wanted to stay and help me explain, which was sweet, but I didn't think it was fair to put him in the line of fire. I wouldn't have been there if I didn't have to be. So, after sending everyone else home, I sat on Missy's deck and stared at the newly unshackled pair. I insisted on leaving Jenny hog-tied and gagged for the duration of this discussion. Mama was too shell-shocked to argue, which I thought was a normal reaction to one's first hostage crisis.
You probably have some questions for me," I said finally.
Mama was dry-eyed and mad as hell.
"Jane, what is going on? We got a call that you needed us at the house, and that awful woman just kidnapped us right off your front porch. Why did she do that? Why was she talking about vampires? Thank God your friends were here to help us, or I just don't know what we would have done. Was that your Gabriel, the tall one with the dark hair? He seems very nice, lovely manners. I don't think I like the other one, though, the one in the vulgar T-shirt."
"Mama," I ignored the part where Mama negated my share in her rescue and stuck to the matter at hand.
"Mama,
You probably figured out, from what Missy was saying earlier, that I'm a vampire. My throat tightened around every word. In fact, if you think back on some of the stuff that's happened in the last couple of months, you'll see that there were some pretty big hints. And I understand why you didn't see it, because you weren't ready yet, and I wasn't ready to tell you. But now I have to. I'm a vampire. My mother's jaw hung slack. She paled.
You haven't told Gabriel, have you?
I would have laughed, but it wouldn't have improved the situation. He's a vampire, too. In fact, he's the one who made me a vampire. While they sat, stunned silent, I very quickly told them what really happened the night I was fired, my shenanigans bender. I described Gabriel's following me home to make sure I arrived home safe, and my car breaking down. I told them about the shooting, though I omitted the identity of the drunken hunter. It just seemed petty now that Bud was dead. I also glossed over the more erotic aspects of Gabriel's turning me because I liked to be able to look my father in the eyes. I would have to put that off for a while anyway, because looking him in the eyes at the moment made my chest hurt. I assured them that I hadn't fed on anyone living and planned to stick to bottled blood as much as possible. I judiciously omitted the Andrea episode. Daddy's face contorted in alternating waves of rage, sorrow, and overwhelming curiosity. Mama's first question was, "Have you tried not being a vampire?" To which I responded, "Yes, for the first 26 years of my life." My father, who had remained silent and thin-lipped until this point, asked, "Why did you lie to us, honey?" The hurt in his voice made my throat constrict. "To keep you from looking at me like you're looking at me right now, like I'm some kind of freak, like you're ashamed of me, like you're not going to want me to be your daughter anymore. I was scared, and I didn't know how to tell you. And after a while, it seemed really difficult to fit, 'Guess what? I'm undead,' into a conversation."
"But you didn't just lie to us once, Jane," Daddy said softly. "You've had months to tell us. You lied over and over."
All I could muster up was a weak, "I'm so sorry, Daddy."
"Are you all right?" Daddy asked, tears of his own welling up. Did it hurt?"
"Being shot hurt," I admitted, reaching for his hand. His fingers wrapped around mine without hesitation. The weight that was crushing my chest seemed to wiggle loose. Getting turned was just like falling asleep. I woke up 3 days later, and Gabriel took care of me. He saved me. I would have died without his help. Please don't be angry with him or act weird around him. He's a good man, for the most part.
"What can you do?" he asked.
It took me a few seconds to catch up to Daddy's question. He was asking about my snazzy new vampire powers, not expressing helplessness about my being turned by a guy with shoves trees on people tendencies.
A lot of stuff, except, you know, eat solid food and go outside during the day," I said.
"Even my pot pie?"
Mama cried.
"Yes, because in this situation, pot pie was what we should be focusing on."
I nodded. "But the upside is, I don't have to feed very often. I can lift couches over my head one-handed. I finally stopped running like a girl. I can smell fear. And you saw that I can hold my own in a fight. You don't have to worry about me anymore." Daddy's expression brightened. And yes, I intentionally left out the part about the mind reading because that tended to weird people out. Plus, it was a hand I didn't want to tip to Mama. After a long pause, Mama said,
"Well, I don't know what to say."
Daddy checked his watch and marked the time. "It took 30 years, but it was bound to happen sometime." Mama looked horrified. I started giggling, which made Daddy laugh. Then we just kept braying like donkeys until tears were streaming down our cheeks. I was so glad that dying hadn't ruined my sense of humor, or Daddy's for that matter. Mama wasn't as thrilled.
"Well, that's fine, just fine,"
she cried fat crocodile tears, clumping her carefully feathered Maybelline great lash.
"You two just sit there and laugh your fool heads off. You have your cozy little meeting of the We're Smarter Than Sherry Club, as usual. I'll just go home and mourn my daughter's death."
"I'm not dead, Mama. I'm undead. There is a difference."
"Well, pardon me for not knowing the right words," Mama huffed. "I've never met a vampire. I don't know any. No one I know does. Oh, my, what are people going to say? What kind of mother am I to let her daughter get turned into a vampire?
I snorted. I'm not asking you to march in any pride parades, Mama.
Daddy stood, wedging himself in the crossfire. Now, let's not say anything we'll regret.
Oh, I think we're already there.
I was fully prepared to vamp out and leap onto the roof just to complete Mama's traumatic offspring treachery scenario. She was definitely sending Reverend Neil after me for this one.
You didn't let me get turned into a vampire.
I didn't let me get turned into a vampire. It just happened, and there's nothing I can do about it.
Honey, please, we're just trying to understand what's happening, Daddy pleaded.
Mama and I trenched ourselves in a sullen silence. Poor Daddy just looked back and forth between the two of us, like some spectator held prisoner at a tennis match.
How do you expect to live this way? Mama finally demanded. How will you work? Where are you going to live? How will you take care of yourself?
I've been taking care of myself for quite some time now, I insisted. I'm going to keep living at River Oaks as long as someone doesn't try to kill me for it again. And I've gotten a new night job at a bookstore. I'm going to be fine, Mama. You know, Zeb joined this group, the Friends and Family of the Undead. It's like a support group for people who know newly turned vampires. I think it might help you.
You told Zeb before you told us?
Mama shouted. Oh, crap.
How could you do that?
Mama cried.
We're your family.
He found out the night I rose, I said. But no one else knows, except for some of the vampires I've met, and Andrea, a girl who hangs out with a lot of vampires. Oh, and Jolene, Zeb's fiance.
Zeb's getting married? Before you?
Double crap.
We just need to get you over to Dr. Willis and let him take a look at you,
Mama said, moving to pat my leg, then stopping, her hand frozen a few inches over me. She was afraid to touch me. My own mother could not bring herself to lay her hands on me. Something inside me greeted quick, quiet death. There's not much he can do for me.
I don't have to listen to this, Mama snarled. I'm not going to sit here and listen to you talk like this. You can't even try taking it seriously, can you? You died, and you have to make jokes. Have me feel like an idiot for not understanding.
Mama, just let me take you home, I said, reaching for her. She shied away from me.
No, I think we'll stay right here. Why don't you go on home?
Well, because it's not safe for you to be here by yourself. Who knows what Missy has here, whether one of her newbie minions is going to show up. You would be easy prey. I need to stay with you. And technically, I think this is my house anyway. When you kill another vampire, that usually means you get their stuff. Besides, you don't have a car. How are you going to get home?
We'll have Jenny drive us, Mama sniffed.
Great. Bring up the living daughter. One more thing Jenny had on me. Two kids, a husband, and a pulse. I reluctantly untied my sister. With an indignant squeal, she broke loose from the ropes and pulled her gag away. She was about to scream at me when I clapped a hand over her mouth. Don't. Whatever you're about to say, whatever excuse you're about to give, don't. I'm not talking to you for a while. Not until the urge to throttle you goes away. Stay away from the house and stay away from me. Pretend that I don't exist. It should be easy enough considering the practice you've had.
Jane, get your hands off her,
Mama yelled. I stared at my mother. You think I'm going to hurt her, don't you? Mama said nothing. Daddy wrapped an arm around her. Now, Sherry.
John? Don't,
she snapped, pushing his arm away.
Don't take her side.
Stop. Please, just stop, I told her, holding my hands up in my best, I'm not going to attack you stance. It's okay, Daddy, I'm leaving. Daddy shot a bewildered look my way and rose. We'll talk soon, honey. Bye, Daddy. I stepped close to kiss his cheek and was grateful when he didn't pull away. He squeezed my hand and winked at me. Love you.
Love you too,
I whispered.
I'm sorry.
Tears finally spilled over my eyelashes and down my cheeks. He hesitated, then kissed my cheek again. I rounded the house and wiped my eyes on my sleeve. And that's when I learned that vampire tears have blood in them. Bloody tears that my father saw. Great. I pulled my car away from the house but watched from the end of the street. I watched the taillights of Jenny's SUV fade into the distance as my family drove away. Well, I'd finally been honest. My parents knew everything, and they'd heard it from me. Whether my family accepted it or not was up to them. On a positive note, maybe I wouldn't have to go to Christmas dinner that year. Chapter 22. Remember that life, or unlife, is what you make of it. From the Guide for the Newly Undead. I figured that if I could rescue my parents from my super-secret arch-nemesis in a battle to the death, I could face my former co-workers. Besides, I still needed Mrs. Stubblefield's signature for my undead unemployment benefits. I was obviously going to have to find another part-time job until the council unclenched and handed over my ill-gotten gains for dusting Nissy. Personally, I thought they were withholding the money to teach me a life lesson in self-sufficiency and keeping my nose clean. Or something. Also, I thought it amused Ophelia to watch me squirm. And Jenny, aware that she might never inherit River Oaks now that I was immortal, had sent me several legal notices demanding certain antiques and valuables. So now I had legal fees to worry about. It was a nice, clear evening just after dusk. No worry about spontaneous combustion. Vampires live-ish for sunsets like that. Pressing my hands against the doors, I prayed for strength and the fortitude not to use my stealthy vampire powers to do something bad to Posey, or Posey's stupid lunch bag. The first thing I noticed was that the security system was turned off, meaning anybody could just walk out the library's front door with an unchecked book without setting off the alarm. Posey was sitting behind the front desk, flipping through a copy of Elle instead of helping the elderly patron carrying a heavy stack of Agatha Christie mysteries. Despite the fact that I did not punch her in the face on sight, she was not thrilled to see me when I sauntered up to the information desk and asked for Mrs. Stubblefield in my most syrupy sweet voice.
"She's not available,"
huffed Posey as she turned her back on me to give the elderly patron some attention finally. I tapped her on the shoulder.
"Well, could you please let her know that I'll be in the special collections room, and when she has a minute, I would really appreciate just a few minutes of her time,"
I cooed.
"I'll see if she has a minute,"
Posey sighed, rolling her eyes.
"Thank you so much."
I took the long way to the special collections room via the children's department and was greeted by utter bedlam. Outside Mrs. Stubblefield's office, I could hear the mayor's wife complaining about an unwarranted $36 late fee assigned to her account. There was a book cart parked in the middle of the reading room, covered in jumbled books. From the thick layer of dust settled on their spines, it was clear nobody cared whether they needed to be reshelved. In nonfiction, the Go Lightly sisters were fighting over the last available copy of The Secret. I stared in slack-jawed horror at a silverfish crawling over the opened pages of the massive dictionary kept near the reference desk. I'd had post-apocalyptic nightmares like this, dreams of walking into the library and finding it ravaged, abandoned to scavengers and possibly zombies. Apparently, abandoning the library to Mrs. Stubblefield and her niece was not much better. And none of this bothered me nearly as much as walking into the children's department, which looked like Paris, circa 1944. Books were scattered like dead birds across the floor, split open, their spines cracking. The stuffed Mother Goose was in an anatomically correct position with Humpty Dumpty. The bookshelf containing the baby and toddler books had collapsed and was leaning against the wall, broken and discarded. Three little girls were running around the storytime carpet, spiking paperback copies of Junie B. Jones like footballs. 10-year-old twins Jake and Josh Richards sat in the corner, furtively drawing breasts on the women in the illustrated history books. 7-year-old Jimmy Tipton, who had been repeatedly warned not to bring juice to the library, was tossing pre-chewed gummy bears through the puppet theater. His mother, who had been warned not to bring Jimmy to the library, was nowhere in sight. I was prepared to let it go, to walk away. It was someone else's problem. And then I saw Jimmy rip his juice box open and start to pour juice on the carpet. the carpet I'd installed with my own two hands.
"Stop,"
I thundered in a voice not my own. It resonated inside my skull, echoing out over the children in waves. I could see everything, every page in every book, every drop of blood coursing through the children's veins, every drop of Hawaiian punch dripping onto the carpet.
"Stop what you're doing right now."
The children froze. Their arms fell to their sides, and they awaited orders. To think of all the time and frustration this could have saved me during story hours.
"This is not how I taught you to behave in the library. This is not how I taught you to treat books. I want you to erase every mark. I want you to put everything away," I intoned. "Everything. Even if you didn't touch it, put it in its proper place."
The kids scrambled to do my bidding. Even the kids who didn't know the Dewey Decimal System or their alphabet were shelving books. I handed Jimmy a roll of paper towels from behind the counter.
"Blot,"
I told him, and marched into the special collections room. I was nose deep in a rare edition of History of Hematology when Mrs. Stubblefield peeked around the corner. I caught her in my peripheral supervision, but deliberately ignored her until she was standing right in front of me. She jumped when I snapped the book shut and offered a sharp, sweet grin.
"Hi, Mrs. Stubblefield," I chirped, cheerful to the point that it pained me.
She blanched, clearly expecting me to indulge in some sort of Texas Chainsaw fired employee revenge fantasy. I stretched out to scan her mind. She put up no resistance, and I was overwhelmed with chaotic images. I saw whimsically tilted stacks of unshelved books left untouched for weeks. Mrs. Stubblefield finding my reminder, written in red Sharpie, on the calendar to call the exterminator for our annual spraying 2 months after the silverfish invaded. Posey sending out a storytime flyer with the word public spelled without an L. Mrs. Stubblefield fruitlessly trying to reset the server when the online card catalog crashed.
"You asked to see me?"
she asked, as I enjoyed her memory of the library board standing around her desk, demanding to know how she had lost control of the place so quickly. Before I could speak, Mrs. Stubblefield blurted out,
"We were hoping you might come back to your position as Director of Juvenile Services. There would be a decrease in pay, of course, and you would have to take on more evening and weekend hours. I would hope that you would take these inconveniences in stride and recognize this offer for the gesture that it is."
In other words, the library board was telling her to give me my job back, but she wanted my tail tucked between my legs when I returned. I smirked nastily. "I guess that budget issue cleared itself up, hmm?" I knew it was mean, but I was sure I'd get a free pass on that one. Mrs. Stubblefield made a sound somewhere between a laugh and a sob. I looked across the hall to the children's department, a room where I had spent the better part of 6 years. If you'd asked me as I walked into the library that night whether I wanted my old job back, I probably would have said I'd jump at the chance. But it's true, what they say about going home again. Everything about the library seemed so foreign to me now, almost cold. I loved the kids, the patrons, but I didn't belong at the library anymore. There was nothing left for me there. Plus, I didn't know whether I could handle rooms full of chattering children with my super hearing. I smiled. "You know what? No thanks. I'm doing pretty well. Good luck replacing me, though."
"Jane, please be reasonable," Mrs. Stubblefield begged.
"I am being reasonable. I'm not accepting your sad, hobbled excuse for a job offer. The only reason I came here tonight is that I need a signature here," I said, pushing the form toward her. Her eyes scanned the top of the form with Federal Bureau of Undead Affairs in huge Arial font. Understanding flicked across her features, and she turned roughly the shade of wallpaper paste. The moth eyebrows shot to her hairline and fluttered there indefinitely. She stared at the canines I was allowing to edge over my bottom lip. My eyes traced the slightly varicose veins along her throat, her collarbone. I slid a blood-red ink pen across the table for her.
"Oh, wait. It says it has to be signed in black. Silly me. What was I thinking?"
I gave her a wide smile. Red just seems to be my favorite color lately. Now fidgeting with the gold cross she wore at her throat, Mrs. Stubblefield signed the paper. She carefully avoided touching any part of the paper where she'd seen my hands. Thank you. I let a low, hungry note creep into my voice as I said, It's so good to see you, Mrs. Stubblefield. I've been thinking about you a lot lately. I think I may have to come by more often. I stood, refrained from rolling my eyes when Mrs. Stubblefield flinched and stuck my book on the correct shelf. I reached the door of the special collections room and turned back to my former boss. By the way, I've always wanted to tell you. Eyebrows. There should be two. Mrs. Stubblefield gasped in indignation as I swaggered out. I made a point to be pleasant to Posey as I checked out several volumes on remedial gardening and creating healthy boundaries in adult relationships. My hope sprang eternal. And yes, an Aretha Franklin chorus was ringing in my head as I left the building. R-E-S-P-E-C-T, find out what it means to me, I hummed. Gabriel was perched on the Veterans Memorial Fountain across the street, dragging his fingers through the burbling water. How did you know I would be here? I asked when I reached him.
I made a lucky guess, he said.
He nodded toward the library.
What were you doing?
Having a truly excellent moment in my life, I said, grinning shamelessly. One of the best ever, to be honest, before and after you came along.
I don't know how to take that, he said.
Doesn't feel too good, does it?
How are you? He asked.
He pushed my shirt aside and traced his fingertips along the shiny edges of the scar over my collarbone.
Wood wounds take longer to heal. It'll be gone in a few days.
I kind of like it, I said, not bothering to move his hand away. My very first war wound.
So, how are you? He asked again.
Recovering, I said, meeting his gaze. Zeb's still a little weirded out. He watched me kill somebody, which was a horrible new experience. Plus, he had semi-sexual feelings when he watched me wrestle with Missy. I don't know which was more disturbing for him. In another milestone in my emotional development, I sent Jolene a bridal planner specifically written for werebrides, I said, adding flatly. And in exchange, Jolene sent me a catalog of bridesmaid hair accessories.
I'm very proud of you, Gabriel told me. And your parents?
Not very proud of me right now, I said. And my sister is suing me.
I could still talk to them for you, he offered.
What would you possibly say? Sorry I bit your daughter? They're just going to have to work it out at their own speed, I said. I think Daddy's going to be okay. In fact, I think he's kind of leaning toward it being cool to have a vampire daughter. He called yesterday, mentioned that he'd like to talk to you. Gabriel made an uh-oh face. No, I think he just wants to ask you some questions about your Civil War days. When I told him how old you are, he kind of started drooling. I laughed.
It's been a long time since I've had a friendly chat with a special lady friend's father, he said, tugging at his shirt collar. It will be friendly, won't it?
Decidedly, I assured him as he slipped his arm around mine. He likes you. The fact that you're a living record of everything he's ever wanted to know about the history of the Hollow just gives you that much more of an edge.
And your mother? He asked.
Has taken to her bed and is refusing to come out. I think I have been officially written out of my grandmother's will, but really, my name was in pencil anyway, so it hardly matters. I'm allowed to be friends with Andrea again, which is nice. Aunt Jetty says hi, by the way, and that she prefers that you wear pants the next time you're in the house.
I'm sure you'll explain that at length at another time, he said, clearly confused.
I'd forgotten that he and Aunt Jetty had never been properly introduced. My first battle to the death, I said. How many of those am I going to have? Because they're not fun.
They're rare, he assured me. Maybe we could put you in one of those plastic hamster balls for your protection.
That's two jokes in two nights. You're on a roll.
I think you're having a bad influence on me, he said solemnly. It's nice to return the favor.
So, is this purely a social visit, or is there news from the council I should be aware of? I asked, playing with the lapels of his coat.
You've been cleared in Missy's death, he said. Cleared in the sense that the council knows you killed her but feels it was justified. Also, they've ruled that you are not involved in Walter's death.
Does that mean I have to give the Knight Rider DVDs back? Because they were kind of destroyed in the fire at Dick's place.
Where is Dick staying, anyway?
Not with me, Gabriel muttered. And that is all that matters.
You are going to have to come to some sort of truce with that guy, I told him. Now that I know he isn't involved in a conspiracy to defame and murder me, I consider Dick a friend. And as my...
Gabriel's eyes focused on mine as I searched for an appropriate term. Unfortunately, all I came up with was another important person in my life. I think it's important that the two of you get along.
Oh, come on, I'm not asking you to invite him to move in with you.
Gabriel's lips disappeared as he mulled that over. He finally relaxed enough to say,
Ophelia sends her regards. She also said she would like to not see you for several months.
The feeling is mutual, I told him.
The good news is you can expect a rather large deposit in your account soon, he said. And you'll inherit the land surrounding your property, in addition to Missy's other holdings.
I don't want to know how they know my account numbers, do I? I asked. He shook his head. I still have a hard time believing this was all about real estate and money, I murmured as I stared up at the purpling sky. With the weight of an impending murder trial off my shoulders, the world was a beautiful place again. The stars stretched out forever, and anything seemed possible. Except maybe getting a tan. For the first time in a long time, I felt comfortable in my own skin. I kind of hoped that vampires were above petty greed, I said. He smiled that maddening Buddha smile.
Well, we were all human once.
Speak for yourself.
This book is over, but the story continues. Keep listening after the credits to hear the beginning of Nice Girls Don't Date Dead Men, Book 2 in the Jane Jameson series, Free.
This has been an Audible Inc. production of Nice Girls Don't Have Fangs, written by Molly Harper, and narrated by Amanda Ronconi. Executive Producer, Kristen Lang. Producer, Mike Jarzik. Engineered and directed by Raj Makija. Production Coordinator, Kat Lambrix. Copyright 2009 by Molly Harper White. Audio recording copyright 2009 by Audible Inc.
And now, a free preview of Nice Girls Don't Date Dead Men, Book 2 in the Jane Jameson series.
Chapter 1. With foot and paw planted in the human and animal worlds, where creatures mix techniques from both cultures to secure relationships. This can lead to lifelong happiness or a very confused potential mate. Mating rituals and love customs of the were.
I can't do this,
Jane.
It's just wrong, I whimpered. It defies the laws of nature, the thin line that separates good and evil.
Zeb rolled his eyes and snapped the bridle binder shut.
It's just a dress, Jane.
It's a puce dress, Zeb.
Jolene's getting it in peach,
he grunted, clearly at his limit in dealing with whiny, undead bridal party members.
Why are you being so difficult?
Why is your fiancé insisting that I dress like Naomi from Mama's family?
It's not that bad,
Zeb insisted.
Not that bad?
I opened the binder and pinned the offending picture with my finger. The model's defiantly blank expression could not mask her embarrassment at wearing this sateen nightmare. It was off the shoulder, with a wide ruffle of retina-burning color that gathered at the cleavage with a fabric cabbage rose. The traditional butt bow actually connected to what can only be described as a waist lapel. Despite not having that many girlfriends, I had been a bridesmaid 3 times in 10 years. Apparently, I was tall enough to match the rest of the bridal party for Marcy, my college roommate from freshman year. My sophomore roommate, Carrie, had a cousin who had the nerve to get pregnant, and I just happened to fit the cousin's abandoned bridesmaid dress. I'm pretty sure my junior roommate, Lindsay, only asked me because she wanted plain bridesmaids. She said something about not wanting to be outshone on her big day. I was thankful to get a private room my senior year.
My sister Jenny never even considered making me a bridesmaid. Ironically, her reason for not asking me, not liking me, resulted in this inadvertent and certainly unintentional kindness. I'd suffered butt bows. I'd carried those stupid matching shawls that never stayed on past the ceremony. I'd worn mint sorbet, periwinkle fizz, and passionate pomegranate, all of which translated into hideous $175 dress with shoes dyed to match, neither of which you will wear again. And now, Jolene McLean, the betrothed of my best friend, wanted me to wear the ugliest dress of them all. Jolene and Zeb had met at the local chapter of the Friends and Family of the Undead, where Zeb had sought help after my new undead condition left him even twitchier than usual. It was your basic love story. Boy meets girl, boy dates girl, girl turns out to be a werewolf, boy and girl get engaged, and slowly drive me insane. In a way, I brought the two of them together, which meant I had no one to blame for this hoop-skirted fiasco but myself. I knew the whole point of having bridesmaids was dressing them like circus folk so you would look better by comparison. But this was beyond the pale. I'd be lucky if angry villagers didn't pelt me with rotten produce. "This is why I wanted to go shopping with you," I cried, flopping back on the couch with the boneless petulance of a teenage orthodontia patient.
"Well, the bridal barn closes at about 3 hours before sunset, Jane. So unless you're willing to risk bursting into flame just to exercise your control issues over a stupid dress, I think we're out of options."
Humph. I hadn't been a vampire for very long, so sometimes I forgot about the limitations of my condition and the pain Zeb took to avoid throwing said limitations in my face. It didn't mean I was going to wear that monstrosity of a dress, but I would at least stop giving Zeb a hard time. I had developed a nasty habit of needling Zeb since he'd started planning his wedding. Zeb had been my best friend since, well, forever. I was used to having his undivided attention. Of course, he was used to me breathing and eating solid foods. We'd both had to make adjustments. He was just much better at them. It seemed doubly cruel to pick on Zeb now. While some members of Jolene's family were thrilled that she was marrying a nice guy with a stable income and his own home, there were several uncles who declared the union clan shame, the werewolf version of a Shonda. Werewolves are the most highly evolved were species. They have the most regular change cycle and the most complete, dependable changes. Being natural pack animals in both forms, they also have the most stable social hierarchy. There is an alpha male mated to the female of his choice, who becomes the alpha female. While the lesser clan members have property rights and general free will, all major decisions must be filtered through the alpha couple, particularly the alpha male. Everything from mate selection to business management has to be deemed for the good of the pack. Jolene's family was one of the first to settle in Half Moon Hollow. Their farm was now home to the clan alpha couple, Lonnie and Mimi McLean, their three children, 18 aunts and uncles, and 49 cousins. Jolene was the last unmarried female in her generation, which is not to say she had been without proposals. She'd been courted by scions of several prominent werewolf clans. Her own cousin Vance, a tall fellow who reminded me of Jethro from the Beverly Hillbillies, only more broody, had made several failed bids for her paw since she'd turned 17. But it was my gangly, goofy, incurably human BFF who stole her heart away. Lonnie had to tamp down Vance's open griping about Jolene's engagement with a visit to Vance's trailer. It was the werewolf equivalent of a trip to the woodshed. Vance responded by driving to Jeb's house and peeing in his yard. Apparently you have to be male or a wolf to understand what an insult this was. In a werewolf pack, you cannot interfere with the mate choice of a clan fellow. You cannot intentionally harm that werewolf's chosen mate. You are not, however, required to help that person should he find himself in a life-threatening situation. Somehow, Zeb had managed to stumble into several such situations in the few months since he'd been engaged to Jolene. He'd had several hunting accidents while visiting the McLean farm, even though he didn't hunt. The brakes on his car had failed while he was driving home from the farm. Twice. Also, a running chainsaw mysteriously fell on him from a hayloft. He would never get that pinky toe back. Jolene insisted that her relatives were just being playful. I insisted that Zeb not venture out to the McLean farm without a vampire escort, which certainly hadn't improved his stance with the future in-laws. Despite the grudging acceptance they offered Zeb, most of the clan was distrustful of vampires. Some, in fact, wore vampire fangs around their necks next to the gold-plated charms that spelled out their names. On the other side of the aisle were Zeb's parents, Ginger and Floyd, and they weren't exactly thrilled about the wedding either. Mama Ginger had been planning my wedding to her son since we were kids. Apparently, the image of Zeb coming home to my pretend kitchen carrying a briefcase made of newspaper was permanently burned into her cortex. She figured that having known me since I was six and seen multiple examples of my being firmly planted under my own mama's thumb, I was the only acceptable candidate for a potential daughter-in-law. For my last living Christmas, she'd given me a Precious Moments wedding planner with my and Zeb's names already filled in. Mama Ginger saw the world as it should be, according to Mama Ginger. And when something didn't conform to that vision, she went to drastic lengths to correct it. I didn't know what made her think she had the right. It may have had something to do with all the chemicals she inhaled at her not-quite-licensed kitchen beauty shop. Just to give you an example, Mama Ginger could not fathom that I would go to senior prom with anyone but Zeb. So, she told several of the mothers at her salon that I was being treated for a suspicious rash. This fixed it so no boy at our high school would go anywhere near me with a corsage. With no other 11th-hour options, Zeb and I ended up going together. Mama Ginger kept the pictures in a place of honor on her mantle. As Mama Ginger couldn't have her say in choosing the bride, she decided to make planning the wedding as unpleasant as possible. She'd objected to the wedding date, saying it conflicted with her bingo night. Every plan Jolene had was dismissed as alternately trashy or too highfalutin. Mama Ginger was also incredibly insulted when Jolene politely refused the Precious Moments bride and groom cake topper she'd saved for Zeb's wedding. Precious Moments. Gah. I could rip a man's spinal column out through his nose, and I still found those things frightening. Zeb's father, Floyd, had expressed little interest in the wedding after he found out there wouldn't be a Velveeta fountain or a big screen showing the scheduled UK basketball game. So, the reception was going to be fun. As much fun as one could have while dressed as Satan's tea cozy. The Naomi Harper bridesmaids' dresses were a concession to the McLean family tradition of renting formal wear from Jolene's Aunt Vonnie's dress shop, the Bridal Barn. Vonnie made all of the dresses herself, using three patterns, all of which ended up looking like a circa 1982 pattern called Ruffles and Dreams.
"I know, Janie. I know it's ugly," Zeb said, his big doe eyes all guileless and earnest. "Dang it. I always buckled under those baby browns. It's the world's ugliest dress. Of all the dresses you will ever wear, this is the one your body may reject like a faulty organ. As soon as I get back from the honeymoon, I will help you build the bonfire to burn this dress. But I'm asking you, as my closest friend in the entire world, will you please just wear the stupid dress for one day, without whining, or describing it, or making Jolene feel bad, or pissing off Jolene's cousins?"
"Any more conditions?" I grumbled. "I reserve the right to make addendums," he said, one sandy blonde brow arching its way up to curly hair of the same shade.
"What kind of kindergarten teacher talks like that?" I groused. Engagement had changed Zeb. He was more aggressive, more mature, partly from having to defend himself in life-threatening situations. Unfortunately, he was being more aggressive and mature with me, which sucked.
"What kind of children's librarian takes a job at an occult bookstore?" he countered.
"Vampire,"
I pointed to my chest. "And I'm not a librarian anymore. When they fire you, they kind of take the label, too." Zeb's smile thinned as he blinked owlishly and pressed his fingers to his temples. He took a pill bottle out of his pocket. "You okay?"
"Yeah," he sighed. "I've just been getting these headaches lately."
My pessimistic brain flashed on possibilities including clots and tumors. Batting down small flares of panic, I asked, "Have you seen a doctor?"
"Yeah,"
He said they're probably stress-related. I poked a finger at the wedding binder.
I can't imagine.
Wedding planning is stressful, even when you're not marrying into a family with mouths full of fangs and guts full of burning hatred, both of which are aimed at you, Zeb muttered as he dry-swallowed 2 Tylenol. On a brighter note, where's your ghostly roommate?
Out, I said, of my great-aunt Jetty, who had died about 6 months before I was turned and had been pleasantly haunting me ever since. With my grandpa Fred again, they're becoming quite the hot and heavy couple.
I didn't realize ghosts roamed around so much, he said. Where do they go?
As long as it keeps me from seeing 2 deceased old people getting all touchy on my couch, I do not care.
He grinned. That's so gross.
Tell me about it, I grimaced. I'm working extra shifts at the bookstore unpaid just to get out of the house. I keep walking into rooms and finding them... Gah! And speaking of the store, we need to table the dress negotiations for now. My shift starts in about an hour. We're expecting some ancient Babylonian scrolls that Mr. Wainwright found on eBay, so he's really excited. He thinks they may have been used in a summoning rite.
So you purchased ancient Babylonian texts which may or may not call forth Gozer the Destroyer on eBay?
Zeb asked. He cocked his head and gave a goofy grin.
You know, a year ago, I would have thought you were kidding.
I shrugged, pushing the dreaded bridesmaid dress photo from my considerable field of vision. And yet... I scooped up the ringing phone, knowing before I pressed it to my ear that it would be my mother. I didn't use my spiffy new mind-reading powers or anything. Mama called every night before my shift to make sure I was careful on the 3-step walk from my car to the bookstore. She tended to forget that I now had super strength and could twist any prospective mugger into a pretzel. Mama had responded to my coming out as a vampire with the traditional stages of grief. She just got stuck at denial. She had decided to ignore it completely and pretend it away. She brought 2 frozen pot pies over to my house each week to help me out with my meals, which was handy because I needed something around to feed the ever-ravenous Jolene. Mama dropped by during the day, then got upset when the vampire sleepy time instinct kept me from chatting. It was as if she thought I could change my mind about being a vampire and give back my membership card.
I have some bad news, honey, Mama said as I picked up the phone.
She'd long since parted with the niceties of phone greetings. After a dramatic pause, she said,
Grandpa Bob passed last night.
Aw, I moaned.
Another one?
This may seem like a strange, even cold reaction, but you have to understand my Grandma Ruthie's marital history. She'd been widowed 4 times, via milk truck, anaphylactic shock, spider bite, and lightning strike, the lamented aforementioned Grandpa Fred. I wrote a poem titled Grandpa's in an Urn in 5th grade. I had to spend a lot of time in the guidance counselor's office after that. I loved Bob. Despite not being my actual grandpa or even a step-grandpa yet, Bob had always been nice to me. But he was engaged to Grandma Ruthie for 5 years and had chronic conditions of the heart, lungs, and liver. He had survived longer than expected.
Your grandmother says there was some sort of mix-up with his medication.
Mama sighed. I could practically hear the cap from her nerve pills rattling loose. Knowing this would take a while, Zeb got out my blender to begin another batch of experimental Jane shakes. He'd been using a combination of condiments and dessert toppings to make the synthetic blood a little more like the human food I miss so much. My current favorite was Faux Type O, mixed with a little bit of cherry syrup and a lot of Hershey's new blood additive chocolate syrup. The pleasant sensation of chocolate without the unpleasant undead side effects. That was an excellent selling point considering those side effects were the vomiting and agony that came with vampires trying to digest solid foods. Mama's voice trembled under the weight of Grandma Ruthie's expectations.
I don't know what I'm going to do. Grandma seems to think we should be hosting the funeral as the next of kin. Bob's children are having a fit. She's already made a scene down at Whitlow's funeral home over the release of the body. And now she expects me to help her plan the visitation, the buffet, the service.
The full Ruthie Early Lang Bodine Floss Whitaker special? I asked.
I wish you would stop calling it that, Mama huffed.
She's had the same funeral service for four husbands. I'll call it what I want, I snorted.
Jane, I'm really going to need your help with this, Mama said, the faintest wheedling tone creeping into her voice.
Why can't Jenny help you with this?
Jenny's busy with the Charity League Follies, and she's serving as chairwoman of the Women's Club Winter Ball this year.
Mama was in full-blown whine now. But good old Jane doesn't have a life, right? Why not make her chairwoman of the funeral luncheon?
Don't start that, Jane, Mama warned. If you would just talk to Jenny and work out this silly business, you could both help me.
I think it ceased being silly business when I was deposed, I told her. Jenny had made good on her promise not to talk to me after I came out to my family. She had, however, sent me a lovely note through the law firm of Hapscom and Schmidt, stating that Jenny wanted access to the family Bible. The Bible, which contained all of the early genealogical information, had been willed to me through our great Aunt Jetty as part of the contents of our ancestral home, River Oaks. Jenny's lawyers had stated that as a vampire, I could not touch it and had no use for it. I'd had the local offices of the ACLU and the World Council for the Equal Treatment of the Undead send her a cease and desist letter stating that such statements were inflammatory and untrue. She'd responded by sending me a copy of the family tree she painstakingly calligraphed onto parchment, with my name burnt out with a soldering iron. An ugly flurry of legal correspondence followed, and I ended up drinking Thanksgiving dinner with my parents after the rest of my family went home.
Now, don't expect me to take sides, Mama said. You girls are going to have to work this out for yourselves.
Most of the funeral stuff is going to be done during daylight hours, I said. I'm not even going to be able to attend the burial. Humans get upset when vampires burst into flames right next to them.
But you have all the time in the world to plan Zeb's wedding, Mama grumbled.
She always got a little cranky when I brought up the V word.
Where's the happy couple registered? The dollar store?
First of all, that was really funny, I whispered, glad that Zeb had ducked into the walk-in pantry and hadn't heard it. But it was a mean thing to say. I'm the only one allowed to make mean jokes about Jolene's family, as I am the one wearing the ugliest dress in the history of bridesmaid kind.
What color is it? Mama demanded. It's not yellow, is it? Because you know yellow makes you look sallow.
Mama, focus, please. I will help with the prep work for Bob's funeral as much as I can during the evening when I can fit it in around work hours, but I can't do much.
That's all I'm asking for, honey. A little effort, she said, placated.
As little as possible, I assured her. How's Grandma doing? I asked, trying not to let the resentment in my voice bubble through the phone line. Should I stop by her house on the way to work?
No. Mama said in a sad attempt to be vague. There's going to be such a crowd there.
And it would be a shame for me to come by and make things awkward, I finished for her. The heavy silence on Mama's end said I was right, but Mama preferred not to put it into words. I don't know why Grandma's rejection of me still stung. Elderly relatives were supposed to give you lipsticky kisses and ask intrusive questions about your love life. They were supposed to brag about your achievements to the point where non-relatives wanted to gouge their eardrums at the mere mention of your name. They were not supposed to require at least 1 week's advance notice if you attended family gatherings, or insist on wearing a cross the size of a hubcap whenever you walked into a room. My only consolation was that Grandma looked like Flavor Flav and usually tipped over under the weight of her bling. Eager to get back to a subject she could control, Mama listed the dishes she expected me to prepare to perk up the usual funeral potluck offerings. Apparently, there was some sort of dessert involving jello, cream cheese, and mandarin oranges in my future. While I saw it as completely unfair that someone who didn't eat should have to cook, these arguments failed to impress Mama. I promised to come by for my assigned shopping list after dark.
How are things going with that Gabriel?
Mama asked. Mama was happy I was dating someone, particularly someone who literally came from one of the oldest families in town, but she was pretending that Gabriel wasn't either. I could only expect so much.
Have you seen him lately?
Not for a week or so. He had to go to Nashville for business. On the other end of the line, Mama sighed. Dang it. I had just extended the conversation by about 20 minutes. Ever since I'd established a semi-sort of relationship with Gabriel, Mama's favorite activity had been giving me relationship advice. I thought she saw it as a girly bonding thing.
Honey, what have I always told you?
Now, honestly, that could be any number of things, ranging from avoid contact with any surface in a public bathroom to men don't buy the cow when you hand them the keys to the dairy. So I took a shot in the dark. Never trust a man with two first names, I guessed.
Well, yes, but not what I had in mind.
Never trust a man with a remote control fireplace, I suggested.
No,
she said, her patience audibly thinning. Never trust a...
Honey.
I could almost hear Mama shaking her head in dismay at my lack of man savvy.
Relationships are 50-50, give and take. You have to make an effort. He's up there all by himself for a whole week. Why couldn't you go up and visit him?
I have to work. And isn't that kind of desperate?
There's nothing wrong with showing some interest. You could make a little more of an effort. I could have Sheila take a look at your hair.
Mama, I really need to get off the phone if I'm going to make it to work on time, I said. And Zeb's over here and we're trying to talk about bridesmaid stuff. I've really got to go.
Don't let them put you in yellow. You know how washed out you look in yellow, Mama was saying as I put the receiver in its cradle.
Someone has to lock my grandma up. She's single-handedly taking down the greatest generation, I moaned. Zeb smirked at me as I slumped down and smacked my head against the counter. In a granite, muffled voice, I told him, Shut it, or I'm calling your mama and telling her that your parents' names aren't on the invitations. That'll keep you tied up for months.
Well, that seems uncalled for, he muttered.
From were-weasels to werewolves, wares are territorial creatures. Once a pack has established a home, they will not leave that location for generations until the local food sources have been depleted or they're burnt out by angry farmers. Mating rituals and love customs of the were. Half Moon Hollow is a strange place for a vampire to spend her days. We don't have a performing arts center or a museum, but we have our own Rowdy Rural Towns episode of Cops. The program had never before featured the arrest of a naked guy stealing anhydrous ammonia. The Chamber of Commerce had a hard time fitting that into the brochure. Living in Kentucky is a mix of the ridiculous and the sublime. The same state that is home to top-shelf research hospitals, major manufacturers, and thoroughbred racing is a place where you can attend a school bus crash-up derby. They do take the kids off the buses before they race them. We have opera houses and Opry houses. We have cities that are home to hundreds of thousands and towns like the Hollow, where one day, if the right couple gets engaged, the entire population will be related by marriage. News of my transformation was slowly making the rounds of the Hollow kitchen circuit thanks to my former boss, Mrs. Stubblefield, using my application for undead employment benefits as justification for firing me from my position as the library's director of juvenile services. Of course, she fired me hours before I was turned, but that didn't keep her from crowing, I told you so. She couldn't possibly let someone like that work around the public, much less as a children's librarian, she told anyone who would listen. Mrs. Woodley, whose five children I personally tutored in the library's Reading Remedy program, told her to shut her mouth or she'd toss Mrs. Stubblefield's lumpy butt out of the Half Moon Hollow Ladies' Garden Club. I sent Mrs. Woodley a dozen frozen pot pies as a thank you. Mrs. Stubblefield had recently retired, was asked to retire, after a band of roving teenagers, without my after-school tutoring program to keep them occupied, stuck pages from nudie magazines in all of the encyclopedias, and no one on the staff noticed. For a month. Plus, there was evidence that Mrs. Stubblefield shared her morning coffee with Jack Daniels. Mrs. Stubblefield's retirement meant that her stepdaughter, Posey, was the most senior member of the library staff. Posey, who was brought in to replace me, couldn't understand the Dewey Decimal System without sounds-like clues, and laughed the way it was written out. Ha 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 ha. I hated her on principle, and that principle was bitterness. Through Mama, I heard about book club nights, trumped-up late fines, and items being checked out of the cannot possibly be replaced never to leave the library special collections room. Grant application deadlines had been missed, federal funding fell through for Puppet Time Theater and the adult literacy program. Slowly but surely, my favorite library patrons were making their way over to the bad part of town to seek me out for their reading needs. It started when the Wednesday night book club president, Ann Woodhouse, stopped by to talk to me about a selection. Ann had lost faith in Mrs. Stubblefield's suggestion after she recommended that the club read the sequel to A Million Little Pieces. Then Sally Dortch stopped by to ask about Newbery Medal selections for Little Hannah's book report, but she saw Mr. Wainwright's display of fertility idols and bolted. To be fair, giant ceramic phalluses generally send me running for the nearest exit, too. Finally, Justine Markham and Kitty Newsom, the same library board members who helped Mrs. Stubblefield give me the boot, put on trench coats and Jackie O sunglasses to sneak into the shop and magnanimously announce that the board was willing to overlook my vampire status and welcome me back to the staff. I'm not going to say it wasn't tempting. It bothered me to see my library, a place that represented everything human and familiar to me, suffering. To see programs that had taken me years to cultivate crumbling. And I missed my kids. I missed their little faces, still and enraptured during story time. I missed helping each one find just the right book to help spark a love of reading, introducing them to the books that I loved as a kid. Roald Dahl, Louisa May Alcott, Anne M. Martin. I missed bringing teenagers back to reading after they finally got through that horrible, I'm too cool to like anything phase. But I had entered a new phase in my life, and as far as I was concerned, I could still do the kind of work I did at the library, at Specialty Books.
We hope you enjoyed this free preview of Nice Girls Don't Date Dead Men, Book 2 in the Jane Jameson series. To keep the story going, get the complete book today.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.